Have we perhaps already bungled the green recovery? 1 year on, post-pandemic plans to turbocharge energy transition with massive next-generation infrastructure investments still on the rails, but those plans have taken their knocks from fiscal hawks, vested interests, and infighting over what it really takes to make the planet great again. We'll ask about the world's top polluter, the United States, finally passing an infrastructure bill after much political horse trading, one that includes green measures, all the while failing to promise to phase out coal. Meanwhile, at the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, which is entering week two, the focus squarely on reducing hot air from leaders who talk a big game, but when push comes to shove, choose fossil-driven growth over painful carbon-cutting choices. How to stamp out climate cheats, as they're called. How to make governments stick to their promises. Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking how to make the COP summit meet its ambitions. Joining us from Glasgow, Armel Lecomte, Advocacy Manager on Climate and Energy for the charity Oxfam. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lola Vallejo is also in Glasgow, Climate Program Director at IDRI, the Institute of Sustainable Development and International Relations. You focus squarely on how to finance energy transition, which is key to this discussion. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
From Brussels, Fabienne Keller, French member of the European Parliament from Emmanuel Macron's Renew Europe group. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, thank you very much.
And we always like visitors. Randall Krosner, Deputy Dean at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. You're a former governor of the Federal Reserve System. Thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
The France 24 debate, where you can join the conversation, and you have on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24Debate. First came coal, then came oil. For more than two centuries, humanity's phenomenal industrialization has been carbon-fueled. Making the switch ain't easy. Case in point, Washington, D.C., where late on Friday, lawmakers finally agreed on half of Joe Biden's landmark infrastructure legislation. It was a heavy lift that followed much haggling. Still, a win's a win, says the president, whose $1.2 trillion infrastructure plan includes programs to make the recovery go green.
We're going to build out the first ever national network of charging stations all across the country, over 500,000 of them, so that you can make a real auto, and, you know, auto companies are made a commitment that we're going to make 50% of vehicles electric by 2030. So you'll be able to go across the whole darn country from East Coast to West Coast, just like you can stop at gas stations now. These charging stations will be available.
So Randall Krosner, on that idea, first of all, and on how green is this infrastructure bill?
Well, the infrastructure bill is only part of what President Biden is proposing. And so, as you said, it's a much pared-down version of what was originally proposed. And there is another piece that they're hoping to pass in the next few weeks that would have even more more spending related to green. So there's a little bit about electric vehicles, a little bit there, but it's really not the main focus of the bill. And I think there's a lot more to be done. And I think also to be done perhaps in a somewhat different way than the president is approaching things. I mean, obviously, we have to reduce carbon emissions, but we also have to think a lot about how we can work on the other margin. Can we improve absorption of carbon through planting more trees, through innovative technologies like using algae, which are extremely effective or potentially effective at absorbing a lot of carbon? We have to think about a whole variety of things, not just about electric vehicles.
And the fact that, as you say, ambitions have been scaled down, is this just par for the course, or has the new administration underperformed?
Well, I think it's an extremely heavy lift and extremely difficult thing to focus on because, as you've described, we have an economy that has been based very much on carbon for centuries, actually. And so it's difficult to make a pivot quickly. And that's why I think politically it might be easier to move to some of these other things that reduce some of the or increase the absorption as we at the same time try to fight the difficult battles of reducing the emissions.
Joe Biden promising that these are jobs that are going to help people, that they're going to give jobs, his infrastructure bill, and to low-skilled workers. That's what his claim is, and that people shouldn't be afraid of this energy transition because it's going to mean more jobs. Is that true?
So I think the jury is out on that. Now, there are a lot of very strong claims made about green jobs and green energy is going to be driving the job growth in the future. It's possible, but I think there's really not any evidence that's true. We'd have to see over time.
Armel Lecomte, is there evidence that going green creates jobs?
Yes. I mean, there has been a number of research at the global level and in certain countries to show that actually, renewable energy create more jobs than the fossil fuel sector, and I think that's a good way of selling the energy transition also to people about how to make this transition just, and that because there's a lot of concern from work. Workers across the globe, workers in the coal industry, in the oil and gas industry, but also in some polluting sectors. How are they going to be impacted by this energy transition? And it's important to tackle that and to provide answers to their concern. And I think it's important to accompany those people in the transition and to also recognize that. Yes, some jobs will disappear, and but that new jobs will be created. And so, how do you accompany those people transitioning in those new jobs in the renewable energy sector, in buildings as well? There's a lot of emission reduction to be done in energy efficiency in building. So that's an important area, and that's why a number of political leaders and including Joe Biden, of course, I've been pushing forward that jobs will be created as a result of the energy transition.
Yeah, Armel, you mentioned selling it to workers. Whether you're in West Virginia or in Warsaw, the coal industry has got reason to worry. On Saturday in the Polish capital, a demonstration was held outside the European Union's offices there. Trade unions blame soaring energy prices on the EU. And its moves to discourage coal. There, the Poles worrying about the livelihoods of the rank and file.
Yes, to energy transformation, but under fair conditions, quietly, slowly, so that you replace every job that is about to be liquidated with a job in a related industry, where you earn the same wages, where you have similar respect and prestige, and not low-quality jobs.
Fabien Keller, what would you tell that Polish coal mine workers' union representative?
That we share the issue they face as workers in the coal industry. This is why was created in the European Recovery Fund, a special transition fund for the countries very dependent on fossil energies and more so targeted the coal mining. Of course, the situation in Poland is like 70% of the energy now used is coal. So we have to help them massively to change and to transform their industry. It's a question of planet. It's the question, a central question for the COP. And so Europe is sharing this burden by targeting specific funds and also helping financing the transition for the workers to new industries. It happens that the workers, the unemployed people are very low in Poland. So this is made easier by this economic situation, but we have to accompany the industry itself, which we do.
And at that protest on Saturday, they were complaining, of course, that all this is happening in the context of soaring energy prices. They're angry, most notably, that the transition is going to have to happen with natural gas and therefore Russian natural gas?
Of course, energy is a strategic issue at the European level as at the world level. So gas is not, for the long, long term, a good alternate energy, but for the transition period, we have to accept this as a solution to reduce our emissions, in particular in terms of dust and the issues of quality of air in our cities. But we have to have alternatives, and it's true that it creates it asks the question of our relations with Russia, and you know the issue about Nord Stream, about how we are delivered this gas. So this is a main topic of discussion among member states, because energy needs a more European, stronger European policy, because we have different tradition of finding resources. But moreover, more so, we have a strategic plan. This is the Green Deal, to really help all the industry, transport, agriculture, to be less, to produce less emissions. And this is our main goal. We are going to change more than 50 laws for that. And we put a lot of money in our regular budget and in the recovery plan on that mere objective.
Lola Bajejo, when you compare what's being done over in the United States with what the European Union's plans are, as spelled out there by Fabienne Keller, what would you tell us in terms of ambition?
I think the key is that both blocs have committed to reaching carbon neutrality by 2050, which is the goal that is informed by science. I would maybe caution that about the fact that we need to be clear that the end goal to meet the climate challenge is to actually exit fossil fuels. And I would like maybe to come back to the first comment made about the need to maybe increase the kind of negative emission part of the neutral target. We should be very clear that we have to exit coal, but also oil and gas are next in line. And I think some countries here at COP have started to show leadership to talk about the need to accelerate transition away from oil and gas. I think that's going to be a big issue globally. But again, going back to the point made earlier about just transition, the key is not so much how much money you put on the table, but I think also starting an honest discourse with the workers about the end goal, and then starting to negotiate an agreement, one that works for the regions concerned and for the workers themselves.
What's an honest discourse?
So far, we haven't started having seen this. Sorry?
What's an honest discourse with the workers? What does that mean?
I think in many cases, it is about talking about the fact that we do need to exit coal and to stop producing new coal, oil, and gas. I think the International Energy Agency has been very clear that if the world is to be serious about meeting the 1.5 degree target by the end of the century, we have to stop investing in new coal, oil, and gas from this year onwards. And obviously, with the carbon budget remaining, it's clear that even investing in new capacity to produce electricity from gas should be reserved to those countries which are least advanced and don't have any capacity for a stable electricity production and cannot just build from scratch a renewable capacity. And it should be reserved to very rare cases. So I think having this kind of honesty is a prerequisite to having any kind of discussion about a serious transition plan. And I think that's my worry, is that in the US context, because it's so challenged both from the Congress and from the judiciary with the Supreme Court challenge, the real risk is that we paint this really rosy picture about jobs, which is true to a certain extent, but we have to be clear about the fact that there will be important transformations, and that these transformations need to be prepared. And I think that starts with the honesty from the from the governments themselves. So I think it's a tough gig for Joe Biden. And at least I feel like in Europe, we have started having that conversation a bit more clearly, which of course comes with tensions. And it was, in a way, I think it's good that the Polish workers are starting to be worried, because it means that they understand that the European Union resolve is actually there to reach climate neutrality. And I'm sure that we can arrive to a negotiated agreement, but at least it's the prerequisite to solving and meeting their needs.
All right. You agree that perhaps the conversation has been slightly more honest in Europe than it has in the United States, as spelled out there by Lola?
So I don't know. I mean, certainly there's been a lot of discussion about jobs in both locations. So I don't know if it's more honest. I think it's, you know, as a number of the speakers mentioned, it's a real challenge to get the U.S., China, Russia to agree to no more coal. They walked away from that agreement at COP26. This is the greatest point of political pressure that's on them. If they're not going to do it now, it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. And that's why I think, rather than just kind of pivoting back to that again and again, it's important to think more broadly, because the key thing is to net reduce the carbon emissions, and not only CO2, but also methane, which is much more heat trapping, 25 to 50 times more than CO2. And so that's one of the things that I'm a bit disappointed in some of the discussion at COP26, as well as in President Biden's proposal. There's not as much focus on that, of trying to, how can we reabsorb some of the CO2 that comes out? If we're not going to get the political coalition to say no more coal, there are other things that can be done, and I think on a much more cost-effective basis, which may not have the same political economy around jobs. And so I think that's a more effective way to address these carbon issues, CO2 and methane.
Armel Lecomte, we read the headlines here, and we saw in the first week of COP that there was a pledge on methane. There was a pledge on coal signed by some 40 countries. Do you agree with what you just heard there from Randall Krosner?
Well, it's true that it's quite unusual, actually, at a COP to have that many announcements. There's been a flurry of announcements during the first week on ending deforestation, on stopping coal, also on ending public support to fossil fuels. So for the first time, a number of countries, including the US, actually, and the UK, and others agreed to stop public support to oil and gas abroad, and that's a major change and a very positive signal. And again, it's quite unusual at a COP to have that many announcements focusing on energy. And there was this pledge, it's true, on methane. Then there is also, I have to say, a lot of, we don't have a lot of details on those different statements and alliances, and so we have to be, you know, to be cautious at this stage to be able to say that we'll be in a better position with those announcements to reach the 1.5 objective. But that is something to, for instance, the methane pledge doesn't talk about agriculture, while we know that intensive agriculture is responsible for a huge part of carbon emission globally. And so it will be important that, you know, that we leave Glasgow with a clear, a clear agreement on how to phase out fossil fuels, because that's the, you know, if we want to reach that 1.5 degree target, we need to reduce our emission. Though I think the report by the IPCC last August was very clear on the scale of the of the challenge, what countries need to do. And at the moment, you know, climate pledges are not near enough what we need to do. We're still on a path to global warming of 2.7 degrees, and so more needs to be done, and that's what we need. And I think just to respond on the compensation or the absorbing CO2, I think we need also to be quite careful about that, because there's a risk at the moment that a lot of countries, but also companies, are announcing that they will reach carbon neutrality by 2050, but actually they lack details about how they are going to reach it, and especially they don't provide for a lot of them, especially companies, short-term targets, basically by 2030. And so there's a risk that compensation means, for instance, planting trees, and that raises a lot of questions on the use of lands. And we've seen in the past that this can lead to land grabs, especially in developing countries. So this cannot be, carbon neutrality shouldn't be a distraction from acting in the short term. And it's all about reducing emission in this decade.
Yeah, it brings us to the heart of the matter here, because we're at the outset of the second and final week in Glasgow. How to finance energy transition for the developing world so it doesn't have to fire up oil and coal. And how to clamp down on those who, as Ahmed was talking about, are a little bit light on substance when it comes to their carbon-cutting pledges. James Mulholland has more.
Organisers feared the worst, so the announcements coming out of Glasgow are at least reassuring. After the first week of discussions, the COP26 participants reached a consensus on a number of measures to rein in greenhouse gas emissions. But on Saturday, environmental activists across the world took to the streets, fed up with distant targets and lack of concrete action. For them, it's time to hold the world's leaders to account, starting with the $100 billion a year in climate financing to help poorer nations transition to greener energy, which was supposed to materialize last year.
The first thing is to make sure that the regular assessment of the richer countries' emission reduction targets should be happening on an annual basis. We can't wait for 5 years. When the finance is being discussed, we cannot have another situation where a target that was agreed 12 years ago, the $100 billion a year, still hasn't been met. So we need to ratchet up the pressure and make sure the richer countries deliver.
One of the key commitments so far is limiting the use of coal. More than 20 new countries added their pledge to end the use of the most polluting of all fossil fuels by 2030. But conspicuously absent from the signatories, two of the biggest users of coal, China and the US. However, Washington did join other countries in agreeing to end the financing of fossil fuel projects abroad. It's another significant announcement, with international financing worth 12 to 15 billion euros per year. Among the other announcements, a commitment to end deforestation by 2030 and reducing methane emissions by 30%. Holding all partners to their pledges will be difficult, especially for developing countries. Indonesia, home to the world's third largest rainforest, has already reneged on its commitment to stop deforestation, but there have been some signs of progress, with the European Union, the United Kingdom and United States among signatories of an $8.5 billion partnership to wean South Africa off coal. As for carbon emissions, the outlook remains bleak. After a slight dip in 2020, thanks to the coronavirus pandemic, greenhouse gas emissions have resumed their upward trajectory and are now close to pre-COVID levels. The United Nations says the world is heading for catastrophic global warming of 2.7 degrees Celsius by 2030, far beyond the 2-degree limit agreed at COP21 in Paris.
So, Fabienne Keller, we heard there in that report some of the major challenges in this second week as they discuss climate financing and some of the, as Armel Lecomte was talking about, some of the shorter-term measures to accompany this move to this energy transition move, most notably this bid to end international fossil fuel projects abroad for companies. I know this Monday the Dutch agreed to sign on to it. Should we expect the French to sign on to that as well?
I have no information about that signing, but I think it's a very good result of the COP that some firms take involvements and register what effort they want to make. May I say that I support fully the point that Armel Lecomte just did. it's very important to have short-term goals and not only long-terms, because then you, you know, you let the time go and you don't change what's going on in your country. So this is why the goal of 2030 is important. As you know, we have a goal in the European Union, minus 55%. That's a huge one. So we have to start this transition. And as you showed before, having the Polish workers reacting, it's because it's going to be implemented. And this is, for me, the whole issue of the COP26, not anymore waiting each other's, but each of the countries taking part of the COP, taking engagement for a realistic horizon. And I would also support the idea of the annual evaluation of the result of what we are doing, because it should be a real shock for everyone. In Paris, we were talking about 1.5, maybe 2, and now we are talking about an average possible height of temperature of 2.7. The situation is not at all improving by itself, even though we are discussing a lot about it. We have to put that into action. And may I say that Europe is very proactive. I must say that both the Commission and the Parliament are carrying a strong objective. Sometimes the governments are more resistant because they have to cope with the transformation of agriculture, of industry, but the political will is there. And even with the political will, it takes time. You cannot change things from one day to the other. So I hope that most of the country will feel this pressure, and that in their NDCs, their real engagement, they will propose figures at the end of this week.
Randall Krosner, I see you listening carefully to what Fabienne Keller was saying. In the U.S., people are much more wary of government being part of the solution on something like this. But is this one of those cases where if you want things like grids that work better, if you want things like what you were talking about, carbon capture, that you need public money for this? Do your students feel that way, or are they just looking as to whether or not the energy transition is profitable?
No, it always comes down to incentives. And so it is very important that the incentives are right. And so there's a disincentive for traditional hydrocarbons, and there's an incentive to try to get a net reduction. And so you can see, even with Joe Biden, who is perhaps the most green president we have ever had, he couldn't get the political support to sign on to the coal statement. And so I think continuing to just try to push on that without thinking about, well, how can we reduce the net impact and try and really focus on some of these other innovative technologies, doing research on these areas, super important.
What is your what are your thoughts when you listen to Fabienne Keller talk about how, well, you know, it's a public initiative that that drives what's going on in Europe right now? Should there be a public initiative in the U.S.?
Well, I think, certainly an important part of the infrastructure program is that, and I think the proposal that President Biden has going forward have that. But I would have to say that in Europe, there's a lot of discussion of it, but exactly as the other speakers have said, not a lot of progress have been made. And so I think the atmospherics are a bit different, but I'm not sure the substance is so much different.
Do you agree with that, Lola Vallejo?
I fear when I listen to Mr. Krosner that what he means by innovative technologies is investing massively in carbon capture and storage technologies, which could be seen as a way to continue the business as usual, but try and imagine that those technologies will be able to capture and store the CO2 deep in the ground, and that this will effectively solve the CO2 problem, at least for a period of time. And I think we should be very clear about the fact that these technologies are still at the prototype phase, that we need to invest in them because we will need them not only to compensate for those harder to abate sectors such as international transport, industry, and agriculture, where there are non-CO2 emissions which are very hard to bring down to zero, but we should also be clear that the goal should be to have a zero carbon energy system that then works towards, the transport system, the building system, and that these should reinforce themselves. But we should also have a lot more emphasis on energy efficiency and reducing the demand for resources. And I feel like this has not really been central in also the vision of the transition that is being put forward. And I think we should be very clear about the potential of these technologies to solve the problem. So I think beyond the question of incentives, I think we should also be very careful of not creating a hype regarding certain technologies which could just be used as a way to continue the statu quo.
The point is, the amount of resources on our planet are limited, Randall, right?
For sure.
So you and the problem with capitalism since the 17th century has been its extraction and then transformation of raw materials. And it feeds off of doing more and more and more, right? So at some point, someone's got to curb that a bit?
Well, the other part of capitalism has brought hundreds of millions, billions of people out of poverty. So there have been positives that come with that. But I agree that we have to think about the transition, and we have to think about what is the most effective way to do that. We've heard a lot about people don't want to lose their jobs. People want to maintain their incomes. That's perfectly reasonable. That's why I'm a little bit skeptical about people saying, oh, we can just make an easy transition to green energy without it being more expensive. Well, things that are labor-intensive, activities labor-intensive, tend to be very expensive. And so that's why I think, you know, investment in new technologies for carbon capture, for innovative things like using algae, which is something that can be very, very effective at capturing carbon, being very creative on that. It's not to say that we shouldn't be working on the other margin, but it seems like all the
including
emphasis...
Including energy efficiency, as was stated?
We could work on all of those margins, but it just seems that all the focus is on one margin rather than on both. And we have to try to move as quickly as possible, particularly on something like methane, because methane doesn't stay in the atmosphere quite as long. That's something we can move more quickly on, like in agriculture that was mentioned. It's extraordinarily important if we're going to make progress on methane to include agriculture.
Fabienne Kerrer, you agree?
It's important to include agriculture, of course. This is what we are doing in Europe, tending for more bio-agriculture, for methodology that recognize also techniques that recognize the amount of entrance you are using to reduce your energy footpath. It's important to invest in the sector of agriculture, but no one solution will be enough. We have to invest a lot in transport, developing techniques that are less using oil. Of course, the electric car, but we have to develop public transportation, which is much less using energy than individual levels of individual cars. We have to work to help our industries to transform their process. And may I say that I'm a little worried because I read that the states will not think about a carbon adjustment mechanism. We have in Europe very strong rules for the carbon emissions of our heavy industries. But the problem is that they are in a very bad situation in terms of competition to products produced elsewhere, for example, steel or transformed petroleum products. Then you have the risk of relocation of these industries, and the result in terms of carbon emissions is zero, except if we create this differential cost, the cost of the CO2, that permits areas to finance that actually their restrictive rules. And if, for example, the states and Europe have roughly the same rules concerning carbon emissions, then there will be no adjustment. So it's encouraging countries for technologies that are cleaner, that are less emitting less carbon. So I wanted to make that point because I think it's really important to be coherent among the countries in the world, as well as we have to access to this $100 billion of help to the southern countries that have the double punishment.
So I was just going to say, Fabienne Keller, you're saying effectively, just as we've agreed in recent weeks or heard the announcement from the G20 about global rules on taxation, we can have global rules on taxing carbon?
Yes, we should converge. We should target this. As we are in a situation now where the way the carbon is taxed today is very different, we can apply the system in certain areas without destroying the entire industry by creating this adjustment system that in an ideal world will disappear in a few decades as all the countries in the world apply progressively common regulations and try to help the industries that are less emitting carbon, because when you have to pay for the CO2, then you try to emit less, smaller quantity. So I think this kind of work of objective is very important and must be shared among the world. But I want to make the balance point, which is we have also to help the countries that are not emitting a lot of carbon and that are going to suffer the most from the elevation of the temperature, and those are the countries, the islands, the countries around the earth, and most of them are very poor countries. So we have to get to this $100 billion of help to adapt, to get prepared to the elevation of the temperature. We decided all together in Paris, but we have to now to get to it.
To enact it. That's a crucial point. Just very briefly before we get to that point in full, because it is essential. Randall Krosner, you agree that anything less than global agreement on something like a carbon tax would be unfair competition practices?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult to get to that. I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing a number of countries not agree to some of the same commitments that other countries have. And that's why I think if we wait for that, we're going to be waiting too long. And that's why I think I'd pivot to trying to work on some of these other margins, because if we're waiting for a global agreement on that, I think it's going to be past 2030.
All right. Among those in Glasgow, your former colleague at the University of Chicago, a faculty, former U.S. President Barack Obama. And this Monday, he talked about climate finance, what Fabienne Keller was talking about.
Live in big, wealthy nations. Those of us who helped to precipitate the problem, we have an added burden to make sure that we are working with and helping and assisting those who are less responsible and less able, but are more vulnerable to this oncoming crisis.
So, Armel Lecomte, what does your crystal ball tell you when it comes to climate finance and what we're expecting out of this COP26 summit?
Well, clearly, climate finance is one of the three like big issues at COP26, alongside the 1.5 target and loss and damage as well. I think it's basically we arrived in Glasgow with a number of reports showing that the promise made by developed country 12 years ago in Copenhagen of mobilizing $100 billion a year by 2020, where we learned from different reports, including one by the OECD, that this promise won't be met in 2020, and actually it will probably only be met 3 years late in 2023. And on top of that, we also learned that only 25% of international climate finance is going to adaptation, while at the same time impacts of climate change have increased over the past 6 years. And there was a chapter in the IPCC report this August specifically on that, linking those extreme weather events to climate change. And so that's there's a very strong call from developing country in Glasgow to increase finance for adaptation. There were very vibrant calls from developing country leaders last week, and especially the fact that we should reach 50% of climate finance for adaptation, as the Paris Agreement says. And so,
Ahmed, let me ask you because we're running short on time here. What do you do about countries who promise they'll do their bit when it comes to climate finance, but don't deliver? What should be the rule?
Well, I think because what's interesting when you talk about finance is that we arrived in Glasgow after the pandemic when we saw that actually developed countries managed to mobilize billions and billions of dollars and euros to save their economies, to support their citizen, and so it's really about political will here, and so I think there's a lot in Glasgow to name and shame those countries that are not increasing their climate finance. And I have to say that even though the US has announced that they will double their climate finance by 2024, the US is still far behind the EU on that front, and so that we expect them to do more, and we expect an agreement at COP to reassure developing countries that yes, adaptation finance will increase, that they will make up the delay in reaching the $100 billion. So I think that the money exists. I think we know that the IMF released a report recently showing that $6 trillion are still going into subsidizing fossil fuels. So this money needs to be reallocated to helping those countries, adapt to climate change, but also to develop in a more sustainable way. So it's really about coherence here.
All right. Armel Lecomte in Glasgow, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank as well Lola Bayeo, who is also attending the COP26 summit, Fabienne Keller in Brussels, Randall Krosner, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.